There's never been a better time to get outside and experience the benefits of nature. Discover nearby trails and explore the outdoors with AllTrails. Download the free app today and find your outside.
From the choked supply lines of southern Ukraine to the high-stakes diplomatic theater playing out under the stadium lights of the Middle East, the quietest gears of global conflict are often the deadliest. Welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Kervin. And this week, we are stripping away the noisy headlines to look at the calculated, invisible maneuvers truly shaping the board. In Eastern Europe, Kyiv is waging a slow, suffocating war of logistics, prompting a desperate Kremlin to escalate its nuclear rhetoric and successfully fracture the once-solid wall of European cohesion. Meanwhile, we are decoding a dizzying maze of international leaks and public sabotage disguised as peace negotiations in the Middle East, where the only thing holding back an immediate regional war might just be the ticking clock of a global soccer tournament. And right here at home, Washington is engulfed in a dangerous information war, a declassified intelligence drop regarding U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine that threatens to weaponize past media failures into a full-blown domestic conspiracy. Are we witnessing masterful strategic leverage or the rapid erosion of institutional trust across every domain? Let's get into the state of play. We will, as always, start in Ukraine. And I want to start with something that surprised me this week, because everyone's been watching the big front lines, but the thing that actually moved felt a lot smaller. The supply roads, the bridges. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, and I think you have the right instinct there. Look, the headlines love all of the dramatic stuff, the deep strikes, the cities in chaos, but the real story is logistics.
Logistics. That's interesting, because most of us probably think of a war as violence and death, but you're saying the real differentiator is logistics.
Yeah, look, logistics wins wars, and Ukraine's been quietly choking the supply routes that feed Russian forces in the south. The land bridge into the occupied areas, the ports, the crossings. And it's independent analysts, not just Kyiv, that are saying it's working.
Right, and that distinction matters to me, because when a country at war says, we destroyed all this stuff, I always raise an eyebrow.
And you should. Everyone inflates what they're doing in wartime. This is both sides. We're not just talking about one side here. But when a neutral research group says resupply to a whole sector got cut off, that is a different weight of evidence. That's the part I'd actually hang a hypothesis on. And here's what I think the tectonic piece is. When one side starts losing the slow, boring logistics war, they tend to reach for the loud, scary tools instead. As I say that right on cue, Russia has begun the nuclear talk. So we had a Russian minister this week basically reminding everyone, you know, all means are on the table, including the nuclear ones. And they're saying this, that they're together with Belarus on it.
And I'll be honest, that word lands every single time it's used. So I have to ask the question, the audience is screaming, should we be scared?
That's a fair question. My read here, and I want to be very careful, this looks like it's just signaling. It's not a shift in posture from Russia or Belarus, for that matter. We've seen this before. The rhetoric tends to spike exactly when the conventional picture turns against Russia.
So it's almost like a tell. Like, the louder the talk gets, the more it can mean things aren't going well on the ground.
Right, but almost certainly signaling is not the same as we should just ignore it. So you watch the actual readiness indicators and not the speeches in these big events here. But the speech itself, that's actually a pressure lever aimed at Western nerves.
Which connects to something I found kind of clever and kind of sinister, depending on how you look at it. This claim that Russia's been nudging drones into neighboring countries' airspace on purpose.
And we should say that this is a Ukrainian claim, so handle that with care. But strategically, it fits a pattern. The goal isn't the drone. The goal is to make Ukraine's neighbors nervous and split the coalition.
Divide and tire everyone out.
Yeah, divide and exhaust, yeah. And whether or not that specific airspace story holds up, the strategy behind it is real, and it's working in at least one place.
Bulgaria.
That's right, Bulgaria.
Okay, walk me through this, because on paper, it didn't look huge. They weren't a giant weapon supplier to begin with.
Right, if you measure it in tonnage, it barely registers. The material impact here is small, but that's not why this matters. It matters because it's the first crack in the European wall. So for 2-3 years, the European story has been remarkable cohesion, everyone rowing in the same direction. And now you've got a government essentially saying, look, guys, we're out on this one. This won't be won on the battlefield. You guys need to send negotiators, not weapons. Find a deal.
And I want to be fair to that view because it's not a cartoon villain position. A lot of regular people feel that the how long can this go on, look at the human cost instinct.
No, and we should resist the urge to be angry at Bulgaria here. Look, they have a genuine concern. The analytical point isn't whether they're right or wrong morally, it's that cohesion is the game. And one defection makes the next one even easier. And that's the contagion question. Is Bulgaria a one-off driven by its own domestic politics? Or is it the leading edge of a fatigue that pulls in a couple of other reluctant European members? That's the thing I'm watching for over the next stretch.
And it's such a contrast, right? Because the same week one country steps back, you've got Ukraine sitting at a summit with the Nordic and Baltic crowd, and the accession to the club conversation actually moving forward.
Yeah, and it's almost a split screen here. So on one screen, deepening integration. It's got the European project pulling Ukraine closer. And that's both symbolically and politically that they're pulling them in. Now on the other, the first defection on weapons. So both of these are true at the same time.
Okay, so which one wins?
Yeah, I mean, I genuinely don't know yet, and I'd be lying if I gave a clean answer here, but the tension between those two things, that's the story for the next few months. Not the front line, the cohesion.
Okay, but here's what nags at me. There's all this talk about wanting a diplomatic track. Everybody says they want talks. The Western allies put out their conditions. There was a letter to Putin, and yet it went nowhere. So if everyone claims they want to talk, why does nothing actually move?
Yeah, it's because nobody in power is actually hurting enough to settle right now. That's just the cold facts in this one. Each side still believes it can improve its position. You got Ukraine. They see the logistics squeeze working. Russia thinks it can outlast Western patience. You don't compromise when you think you're about to do a lot better in this situation. So the talk about talks is really just positioning. It's leverage. You announce conditions to look reasonable and to pin the blame for failure on the other guy. Real negotiation starts when both sides privately conclude the next 6 months won't beat the deal on the table. But as of right now, we're not there yet.
I appreciate that you made the distinction between, that it's the people in power aren't hurting enough to settle, but the people on the ground obviously are suffering the brunt of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it would be factually incorrect if I said that no one is hurting in all of these conflicts, because everyone else is. It is the people who are making the decisions who are not hurting yet. And yeah, it was very deliberate to make that distinction.
Not hurting enough, you mean?
Right. Yeah. Not hurting enough.
Okay. So let's pivot to the U.S. role here, because it really is the elephant in the room. There's this sense that Washington's focus has started to drift. So let's look at the Middle East, because that is where the audience is focused right now. By the time this lands, the narrative will have likely shifted several times. You see one headline claiming the conflict is effectively finished, and then the next says the parties are still miles apart. We have reports of a deal being finalized today, only for Tehran to hit the brakes. So, give me the reality. Which one is it?
Yeah, it's a good question. And honestly, they're both the right one here. And I'm not trying to dodge the question The whiplash here that everyone is seeing, that's not a glitch in the story. The whiplash, I think, is the story here.
See, that sounds like exactly the kind of thing you say to avoid answering me.
Fair point, fair point. I do promise that I'm not trying to avoid it. What I'm talking about here is that what we're watching here is it's not just one negotiation. We're watching two negotiations. And those two are the quiet one in the room, and the other one is the loud one that's happening out in public through all these leaks and very public announcements. And as of right now, the loud one is doing the real work.
Meaning the leaks aren't just stuff slipping out by accident.
Right. I mean, some are, and some is misinformation, but a lot of them are on purpose. So a draft gets out, somebody declares that everything is finished, and the other side quickly goes, no, it isn't. Every one of those is a move aimed at somebody.
So when I see one side basically call a document fake, I shouldn't take that at face value.
Yeah, take it as a move, which doesn't make it a lie. It just means you ask, who is this actually for? That's the whole game.
Okay, then teach us the game. Some insider baseball, one might say. Give us a tradecraft. Leak lands on the table. So how do you actually read it?
Yeah, I think the habit I lean on is you don't really ask, what does this mean? You lay out every explanation that could be true at the same time, and then you start crossing off the ones where the evidence won't hold.
All right, so do it out loud. A leak shows up. What are the options on the board?
Yeah, there's three big buckets here. So the first one is anchoring. So you float a wildly ambitious version so that whatever you settle for later, that's actually going to look reasonable. You're just haggling. So you ask for the moon, so you settle for the driveway. And we've seen this from the Iranian side on multiple occasions. Two, it's not aimed at the other country at all. What it's actually doing, it's aiming inward. So the hardliners, especially within Iran, they leak a hardline version to box in their own negotiators.
So they're tying their own team's hands on purpose?
Yeah, exactly. They're doing this on purpose. And it's baked in to it to get that reaction. And then the third bucket that we put this in, and this is the ugly one, this is all sabotage. So somebody who wants the whole thing dead, they leak it in a way that makes agreeing politically poisonous. We see this with the U.S. That is what's happening with these leaks from the United States.
And here's what gets me, though. Those three can't all be one person's plan. So it's not even two countries playing chess. It's a whole bunch of people with different agendas, right?
Yeah, and that's, I think, the piece that most of the news coverage kind of glosses over. So you'll see Washington, D.C. wants this, Tehran wants that. Like, each side has just got one brain, but they're not. A lot of these signals are people fighting their own side.
Okay, so let me ask the obvious question from the cheap seats. Why on earth would you claim a win before the ink is dry? It feels like you're just volunteering to have egg on your face when the whole thing stalls out the following week.
Yeah, because the audience that matters most is at home. Both sides need to walk out and tell their people, look, we won this one, not the other side. You can't always wait for the ink to dry to do that.
Okay, so the victory lap isn't really for the other government. It's for the living room.
Yeah, it's for the living room. And both living rooms want a very different victory, which is why the two versions of this deal don't even describe the same agreement.
Okay, so pull me back from the spin for a second. Underneath all of this theater, is there a real disagreement here, or is it just messaging?
No, there is a real wall. There are real disagreements here, and it's kind of boring, and that's exactly why it doesn't trend. What I want to say here is this is about sequence.
Sequence, as in who goes first?
Yeah, exactly. Who goes first? One side saying, you do the hard things, you prove it, and then the relief shows up. The other side saying, no, relief on the table first, then we're going to talk about the hard things.
And those don't meet in the middle, do they? That's not a number you can just split down the middle.
Yeah, that's the thing. You can't compromise on who trusts who first. All the clever leaking in the world through social media, that doesn't solve a trust order problem. It actually makes it worse.
So let me bring in the thing I genuinely did not expect to be relevant this week. The World Cup. And you keep saying it matters. You put out two separate posts on Instagram this week where this sporting event was central to your analysis. So walk me through why a soccer tournament has anything to do with the Middle East deal.
Yeah. I know how that sounds, but think about who's hosting it. When the entire world is physically showing up on your soil for a month, you've got two pressures pulling the same direction. You want a win in the domestic space or in the diplomatic space so that you can show off, look at what we did. A peace moment lands really well when the whole planet's watching your country. And second, you really, really don't want to be kicking off another shooting war in an oil corridor while your cities are packed with visitors and cameras. So both of those push toward keeping it calm for now.
For now, being the operative words, obviously, because the tournament will inevitably end.
Yeah, they can't go on forever. Unfortunately, the tournament will end. And here's the asymmetry everyone skips. The clock only really runs for the host, for the United States. The other side's clock is set by totally different things. It's economy, it's hardliners, what's actually happening out on the water. None of that resets when the final whistle blows.
So if you had to call it, make your assessment, what is going to happen?
So I'll give you the careful version here. Could something get signed inside this window? Sure, it's possible. Look, we've heard it's done before and then it wasn't. Maybe it's done as people are listening to this episode. You know, President Trump said it's ready to get signed today. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But I'd hold that pretty loosely right now.
Okay, so what if it doesn't land in this window?
Then the thing I'd watch for moves from unlikely to, right, 50-50 is possible. It's not probable, but it's possible. Once the host's reason to keep the lid on all of this expires, the floor under all of this gets a lot thinner. Look, the waters in the Middle East are still contested. Miscalculation is still on the table. Drafting language about reopening the Strait of Hormuz, but on the ground, nobody fully controls the Strait of Hormuz, and there's still activity around it. So you're writing a peace plan over a place that isn't actually at peace.
Which might be the whole story in one sentence, honestly.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that massive gap between what the official paperwork says and what's actually happening behind the scenes is exactly why I've been hung up on this other story. I've been sitting with this all week, and I honestly don't know what to make of it. The outgoing DNI, Tulsi Gabbard, dropped these declassified slides, and the press release that comes with them is a lot. Quote, withheld from the American people, end quote. Now she cares about things being withheld from the American people because she's out of her position, but okay. Quote, international cover-up, end quote. I mean, if that framing is accurate, that is enormous, but something feels off right from the jump.
Yeah, I think your instinct here is correct, because if you go and actually read the declassified slides, not so much the press release, but the actual declassified slides, you get a completely different picture. So everyone's picking a lane on this. It's either that this is the bombshell of the century, or it's just a big nothing burger. And both of those reactions are actually the problem.
Right, because the truth tends to be somewhere in the middle, and that's the harder story to tell. So walk all of us through this. What are we actually looking at? Because the DNI says, until now, evidence regarding the full existence and funding of biological laboratories had been knowingly withheld from the American people.
Yeah, that's what it says. But honestly, these labs aren't really a revelation. They've been funded by Congress since 1991, and the documents confirm exactly what anyone would have found out if you would have just gone on Google or searched a public government website.
Okay, so walk me through that, because I think that's where people are going to push back. They're going to say, well, if it was so public, why didn't I know about it?
And look, that's a completely fair question to have. So here's what we have. There was a Senate program called Nunn-Lugar, officially the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. It was bipartisan, so Richard Lugar was on the Republican side, Sam Nunn on the Democratic side. And it was created right after the Soviet Union collapsed because the Soviets had left an enormous amount of dangerous material, biological agents, nuclear material, chemical weapons, precursors. It was just sitting around with no one watching it.
So it's essentially a threat reduction program?
Yes. And Ukraine joined in 2005. And Senator Lugar held a press conference, an actual public press conference announcing the construction of a biosafety lab. I get this was, 16 years ago. We've all forgotten about this, but it was very public. It was out in the open and it was documented on the U.S. Embassy Ukraine's public website.
So this wasn't buried in an intelligence file somewhere. It was publicly accessible to anyone who looked, but Gabbard's trying to make it look like she broke this news.
Yeah, like this was declassifying some classified intelligence. But that's not what it was. It was posted online for years, over a decade. This is where I think the media, some of it, they made a critical mistake going back to 2022. Back in 2022, Russia first started making these bioweapon claims. Because what you had were outlets that they just flatly denied that any of this was ever happening. Categorically, they said there are no U.S. biolabs in Ukraine, full stop. That's not true. The labs existed, and they do exist. They just aren't what Russia was claiming that they were. So when you deny the existence of something because of political reasons, even though they are verifiably, physically real, you have just handed the other side a gift that they're going to spend years unpacking.
Because now anyone who does even the most basic of research goes, wait, I can find these labs. I can find the embassy listing. I can find Lugar's press releases. And now the denial, it looks like the proof of a cover-up.
Right. The denial becomes evidence. And to be fair, some outlets actually did get it right at the time. Some that I talk about poorly on a lot of occasions, like the New York Times. In 2022, they reported on the labs factually, but they made the crucial distinction. Yes, the labs exist. Yes, the U.S. funds those bio labs. And here's what they actually do versus what Russia is claiming they do. This is the responsible way to handle it, because those are two completely different things. A research bio lab and a bioweapons lab, very different. And I think a lot of people conflate them because the word bio is doing a lot of the scary work here.
Okay, so let's actually get into the distinction here, because I think this is the piece people most need to understand, and it keeps getting collapsed in on the coverage. What is the actual difference between a biolab that does research and a bioweapons lab? Because when people hear dangerous pathogens, they're not making that distinction.
Yeah, they're fundamentally different in purpose and structure. So a biosafety research facility, which is what most of these Ukrainian labs are, that's where you study dangerous pathogens to try to understand them. You're developing diagnostics, vaccines, early warning systems, and the goal here is to defend against them. You can't build a treatment for something that you're not allowed to look at.
So then what about a bioweapons facility?
Right. So a bioweapons program is something categorically different. You're looking at weaponization, delivery mechanisms, how to make something more lethal, how to stabilize that lethal pathogen in open air, something that Hollywood has done many movies on. And the purpose is offensive, right? And the DNI slides, the actual documents, show threat reduction work, pathogen storage, containment upgrades, disease surveillance infrastructure.
So where does the gain of function piece fit in? Because the press release really hammers on that. And for a lot of our listeners, that phrase is going to sound alarming. It should sound alarming, right?
Yeah, it is it's a very legitimate concern, but it is not a synonym for bioweapons. And that's how it's being used within this press release. Gain of function research, which no one outside of the scientific fields even knew about before COVID-19, is the study of what makes pathogen more transmissible or more virulent. So it's dual use research. It's contested. It's debated seriously among the biosecurity experts. Where the left wing might say that science doesn't debate on this. We should be doing it. That's false. And where the right says that this is being used to create weapons to kill humans, you know, that is false. And the truth is always somewhere in the middle. But in a defensive context, the purpose is to understand what a pathogen could become so you can get ahead of it.
So to be clear, the gain of function finding is not a nothing burger. You're saying it's just that the framing around it is doing a lot of the heavy lifting.
Yeah, it's doing a massive amount of heavy lifting here. And as an analyst, this is the part I actually find truly fascinating. So if you dig into those internal documents that were declassified, the intelligence community actually predicted what would happen. They explicitly warned that these specific laboratory sites were prime targets for Russian information operations. That warning is physically written in the slides that Gabbard released.
So the intelligence community was already tracking the fact that Russia was going to weaponize these labs as a propaganda vector.
Yeah, they documented it internally. And then the press release that accompanied the declassification uses almost the identical framing that those Russian information operations were designed to produce. So whether that's intentional or not, that is a separate question. I won't get into that, but the effect is the same.
So I keep coming back to this question of how does a regular person even make sense of all of this? Like, if you're genuinely trying to figure out what's true, where do you even start? Because you've got a government press release, declassified documents, a decades-old Senate program, and Russia propaganda all living in the same conversation.
Yeah, and I think this is where an analysis of competing hypotheses becomes very useful. So you ask, which explanation requires the fewest assumptions? Is it a massive, decades-long, bipartisan, multi-administration cover-up of something that was simultaneously posted on a public government website? Or is it the real documents? Is it that the real documents are being recontextualized inside a false narrative? The second one doesn't require nearly as many assumptions as the first one. So the documents here don't lie. They show exactly what you'd expect from a 30-year, Senate-funded, publicly disclosed threat reduction program. The narrative around them is what's doing the work.
And I want to go back to the media piece because I think this is genuinely where people get confused. And I don't want to just blame the audience for that. If you're someone who saw coverage in 2022 saying there are no biolabs, like the flat denial, and now you're watching the government declassify documents confirming the labs exist, you feel like you caught someone lying. And honestly, you did.
You did. You caught the coverage in a lie. But the conclusion you draw from that matters enormously. The correct conclusion is that the original denial was sloppy. It was irresponsible journalism. The incorrect conclusion is that because the denial from journalists was wrong, everything else Russia said, that must be true.
We have a lot of irresponsible journalism these days, though.
That's very true.
So, I mean, it's like, okay, if I tell you there's no elephant in the room and there's clearly an elephant in the room, that doesn't mean the elephant is planning to kill you.
Yeah, that's literally the dynamic here. And this is what makes the current version of this story more sophisticated, probably more dangerous than the 2022 version. In 2022, Russia was largely fabricating, right? You could debunk it with primary sources. What's happening now is different.
Because now the primary sources are being used as the evidence.
Exactly. They're using actual declassified government documents and letting the audience's pre-existing distrust of the media do all of that interpretive work. You don't have to fabricate anything if the audience is already primed to read real documents through a conspiratorial lens. It's not the documents that are misleading. It's the packaging, the framing. It's critically what's been left out. Nowhere in the press release does it mention Nunn-Lugar. Nowhere does it mention that Lugar held a press conference. And nowhere does it say this was on the embassy website. Those omissions are doing as much work as anything that's actually in the document.
Selective truth-telling. Okay.
That is, yes, government 101.
But I want to make sure that we're being fair here, too, because there is genuinely new information on those slides, but I don't want listeners to walk away thinking that it's all nothing.
Yeah, that's a good instinct to have here. And you're right, the slides do contain things that weren't in the public record before, specific pathogen inventories at named facilities. And there's a reason why this would be classified, right? You don't want adversaries to know these exact pathogens are at these exact sites, because then they could go in and they could release them, right? And we're talking about pathogens like Ebola, Marburg, the plague, anthrax. There was also documented biosafety failures at a lab in Kharkiv in 2019. A facility in Odessa that had been storing biological materials inherited from the Soviet-era program. These are all real things that warrant real scrutiny. Legitimate questions about oversight, safety protocols, about what's happening in facilities that handle that level of material. That's the conversation worth having. That's the conversation we should be having. It's just not this, what Gabbard's trying to do here, which is, look, I told you so. What I was saying wasn't Russian disinformation. It's not political dunking on gain-of-function research that this press release is inviting here.
Because if you get the diagnosis wrong, if you frame it as hidden bioweapons instead of inadequate oversight of a legitimate program, you get the policy response wrong, too.
Yeah, exactly. And the government is, I'll speak for the U.S. government, is very bad about policy response, right? And in this case, a public, perpetually online group of people that's focused on a cover-up narrative isn't focused on what actually needs fixing. What needs fixing is real reform, dual-use research governance, what international oversight of those programs should look like. Those are consequential policy conversations. And unfortunately, they get drowned out by all the noise.
And the noise is where adversarial actors want the conversation to live. It is almost the midpoint of 2026, and as we discuss each week, the true battlefields of modern warfare are rarely where the bombs are falling. We're operating in an era where strategic omissions in a government press release and the closing window of a sporting event carry as much geopolitical weight as a severed supply bridge. The coming weeks will reveal if these maximum pressure campaigns successfully force adversaries to the table or simply break the fragile systems keeping the world turning. We'll be right here on the monitors tracking every movement. Before we sign off, is there anything else you would like to discuss?
No, we made it 2 weeks in a row. So
yes, thank you, Internet. So actually, he did have something to say. We made it 2 weeks in a row.
Right. He says no and then keeps talking.
Huh?
Said he says no and then keeps talking.
Hey, you know what happens? You had something to say and you said it. Good job. Anything else?
That's it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to This Week Explained. We hope that you found it both informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, we would love to hear from you. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and more, be sure to follow us on social media at This Week Explained.
Thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.
Whoa, okay. This one says you get a free phone if you switch. Hey, this one also says you get a free phone if you switch.
Yeah, they all do, hon.
Huh. The T-Mobile one says their customers had the lowest wireless bills versus the other big guys over the past 5 years. and their latest experience plans have Netflix included, plus a year of Dash Pass by DoorDash. Mm-mm-mm.
Hang on, let me see that. Oh yeah, we're switching.
That's what I'm talking about. Do we clap now or...
At T-Mobile, get savings that keep stacking up. That's value you can feel every day. And right now, bring your phone to T-Mobile and we'll give you $400 when you switch.
Savings based on Harris X billing snapshots from Q3 2021 to Q4 2025 compared to average AT&T and Verizon bills. Comparison excludes discounts, credits, and optional charges. $400 with new account on qualifying line. Unlocked device credit ported 90 plus days with device and carrier and timely redemption required. Virtual MasterCard typically takes 14 weeks. No cash access and expires in 6 months. Card issued by Sunrise Banks N.A. Member FDIC. Visit T-Mobile.com.